724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us, especially on Friday, huh? Everybody has a little bit extra bounce in their step on Friday. They do around here anyway, that's for sure. And beautiful day out there today, too. And a little bit of fog in some areas early, mainly if you got rain yesterday. And I'm sure some of you are saying, did we get rain? We had downpours. Not everybody got wet. Here in the Butler area, there was hardly any rain at all. North of Butler, there was a lot. South of Butler, there was a lot. Thunderstorms, downpours, all kind of stuff. Well, mainly the folks who had fog this morning are the folks who had rain yesterday. It is nice out there right now. And it's going to get gradually warmer and then much hotter as we head through the weekend. We have a good program today. We have several guests. We're going to be chatting a little bit later with Philip Mudd. And Philip Mudd is a retired, CIA guy. As a matter of fact, he was the former director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center. And he worked with the FBI, too. And the discussion that we're going to have with Philip Mudd is about black sites, which were something that the CIA came up with in the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks on 9/11. It's almost 20 years ago now. So what were the black sites? What was that all about? And some other stuff, too, about the CIA's response, immediate response to the terrorist attacks. The outlook on that has changed now that we have the hindsight of nearly 20 years. I'll be interested to chat with Philip Mudd. He's not here in Butler. In fact, he's in D.C., just outside of D.C., but we'll be talking with him on the telephone a little bit later on today. That sounds interesting, and I guarantee you that our first guests who are here with us in the studio will be interesting. We're going to be talking about the Institute for Learning in Retirement. We say hello once again to Tom Call. Tom, it's good to see you again.
Oh, it's good to be back, Dave. Thank you.
We talked with you, it was last year, I guess, about the Institute for Learning in Retirement. And you brought a close friend with you here today.
I did. I brought my wife, who is Verna, and she is here because she teaches several classes at the ILR.
Well, Verna, nice to meet you. Nice to have
you here.
Nice to
meet you as well.
Yeah. We need to explain to listeners who are not familiar with ILR, the Institute for Learning in Retirement. Tom, can you give us a little thumbnail sketch of just what it's all about?
Well, we're a nonprofit organization driven by its members. We believe learning does not stop after graduation. There's always something that is worthwhile to learn about. So we hold, I guess you would say, classes that are taught by experts in their subjects. The experts might be hobbyists, professional people, or even retired Slippery Rock University professors, because we are located in Slippery Rock. Mm-hmm. Many of the classes only meet one time, maybe for an hour and a half, but others may meet more than once if there is a lot of ground to talk about that provokes people's interest. In fact, what we do, we have what we have a fall term from September to November, and a spring term from March through May, so that snowbirds and summer vacationers can attend. And anyone can take a class or join the ILR. You do not have to be retired to join, even though retired is in our name. I will say most of our people are, in fact, retired. They're the ones that have the time to pursue the learning about topics that interest them.
Well, we'll talk about some of the topics as we move along in our discussion here. But this is a fabulous concept. I can remember when I first heard about it some years ago, I said, wow, this is really cool. Because, Verna, it's a no-pressure situation. You know, the only people that are there are people who are interested in that particular subject,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, don't have to worry about discipline or requirements such as that. But it's a very relaxed atmosphere, and it's people who choose to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's
want
no
to
tests
know.
Or anything. No, right? There's no pop quizzes.
No pop quizzes. And actually, because of that, there is a more of a relaxed feel in the group. But also, they're very inquisitive, and they can ask some tough questions, so it challenges as well.
It's a much more relaxed atmosphere from what many of us would remember in school, because you didn't like all of your classes in school. You know, there were some kids who were the real history buffs. They loved history class but hated math. Or vice versa, or, you know, some people that couldn't stand English. You had to take all those things when you were going through school. This is totally different. You only sign up for a class if you're particularly interested in that sort of thing.
Or you want to learn something new or different from what you did. You know, many of them are retired, and they have been through many other things that they focused on in their lives, and now they want to expand into areas that they never had the opportunity to learn about.
So you have been involved in teaching and facilitating a number of these classes. In what area in particular, Verna?
Well, it's interesting. I started out because I have a doctorate in my research in ministry in the area of Alzheimer's disease and spiritual care and families and involvement that way. And so I offered a few times now a class where I talk over those type of things, give them ideas on the different forms of dementia, the issues that strike families, make it difficult, and help them. And then that's really the challenge, because I usually did like two or three in a row like that, so I would have people ask questions, and then I would even do some research and come back to them on information they wanted and individuals and their concerns. And then from that, we have done extensive travel, and I really have a hobby for years in photography. And they asked, well, why don't you do some of those trips? And I started doing that, and they liked my photography so much that they started asking me to do a class on digital photography, which I've also now done.
Wow.
So I have expanded my sharing, and my undergrad degree was in physics, mathematics, and now I'm doing a class related to evolution and creation and ideas like that, just to get people churning in another area of thoughts and ideas.
You're not doing a class in physics, are you?
Not directly.
I'm chuckling because that was absolutely the hardest course I ever took in my life, physics. I didn't think I was going to survive that class. And you majored in it.
Yes, I did. And I taught it for years.
Well, what about you, Tom?
Some of Verna's, she's too modest to mention this, some of Verna's classes were so well received that we had, you know, the room only has so many chairs.
Sure.
So they filled up, and the coordinator asked, could you do the same thing again? Like, could you hold a second session? So where she said, well, I was planning to teach this on two consecutive Wednesdays. Okay, you know what? We'll do it on Thursdays as well. So when she says the members who take the classes are enthusiastic, yeah, she's personally experienced that.
When do the classes in your fall semester start?
September the 9th this time. They go right up to just before Thanksgiving. All the classes are in the daytime, typically between 10 o'clock and 2:30.
Convenient.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We never do anything at night. Well, maybe some of us might go socializing, perhaps, because she's touched on something. We do have the relaxed atmosphere, and you find you're taking classes with people who are also interested in the same topics. It's very easy to make friends that way.
Now, some of the classes will meet only once or twice, some more.
Right.
So obviously they're going to be staggered throughout the fall semester. Mm-hmm. And by the way, September is just around the corner, so
that's one reason this is the perfect time to have this chat, because registration is open.
Mm-hmm.
People who want to join the ILR can take 12 classes. And actually, there's not that limitation because about halfway through, that requirement is dropped and you can sign up for any classes that still have space. You can take a class if you're not a member. You can take one. It costs you a small fee. You can kind of try it out. One of the ways to find out about the classes is to get our catalog or to look at it on the website.
Well, I have a copy of it right here in my hand, and we'll chat about some of the fascinating classes that are available. But just in case, you know, somebody has to leave us before we wrap up here today, let's go over the because if you join, if you become a member of the Institute for Learning and Retirement, then once you pay that membership fee, you don't have to pay for the individual classes. Is that the deal?
In general, that's true. There might be a small associated fee with some of them. Perhaps you're taking an art class and you need to cover some cost of some materials.
Mm-hmm.
There is also one thing we've not talked about. There are trips. There are day trips. They're usually not too far away, so we carpool. Every once in a while, there's a big one that we might charter a bus. So if it's a museum fee or subsidized part of the cost of the bus, yes, there'll be some fees, but they'll be reduced if you're a member.
If you're not a member and you just want to try out one course or something like that, is that horrendously expensive?
Indeed. Generally not. Maybe $15 is a typical price for something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if it's a class that meets, say, four times, you get those sessions. But, again, the frequency is based on the subject matter, whatever the instructor thinks he or she needs to cover the matter.
Can you sign up and pay online?
You can sign up online. I think you probably will have to pay by check. You know what? You could go to the website now.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now the catalog is online. And there are instructions about how to join, how to sign up for classes and trips. If you want a printed catalog, and I'll digress for a minute. I personally like the printed catalog because I can flip back and forth through it several times, looking at the dates, thinking about what I'm interested in.
Vernon and I are both shaking our heads. And we like to flip back and forth, too.
Yeah. You can call and get a catalog. And I'll say the office is staffed by only one person, so if there's nobody there, just leave your name and address, and you can get one. The website and the telephone would be the best way for someone who's interested.
The website, because I'm looking at my catalog and it's printed in here, the website is ilretirement.org. And that's Institute for Learning Retirement. ilretirement.org. And you can call 724-738-1604. We'll give that number again before we wrap up. But that's how you contact. Can you call and get a catalog sent to you, or are they available around the area?
Oh, certainly. We do try to sometimes place them in some of the racks around town, maybe those hosted by the Butler County Tourism Group, or sometimes they'll be in libraries or shopping centers. Our distribution is a bit uneven. We are volunteers. We only have one employee, the one who answers the phone and can direct you. So the best way really is to call and ask for one.
Okay. We'll have a few here at WISR, too. If somebody wants to stop by, we'll keep
it going. I have a box in my car. I like to take them wherever I go.
So those are the particulars. Let's take a break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of these exciting courses that are being offered in the upcoming fall semester of the Institute for Learning in Retirement. Folks, have you heard about this? This is a really great thing. A quick break, and then back to talk more with Tom and Verna here on WISR Friday edition of It's Your Turn. We will be right back. Time for a checkup for your pet. We recommend Suburban Animal Clinic. Or maybe Fido or Tabby's not feeling so well. Suburban Animal Clinic, a small animal veterinary practice located Route 8 south of Butler at the intersection with Thorncrest Drive. It's about 5 miles south of Butler, Suburban Animal Clinic, in the spirit of Dr. Dennis Damon. Their services include wellness checks for your pet, of course, also emergency care. They have laser therapy, dental available, also prescription diets. You know, one of the things that are problems for a lot of our pets these days, being overweight. Microchipping, they can handle that as well. Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, south of Butler. If you're headed south from Butler toward Pittsburgh, as soon as you pass all the auto dealerships, start looking on your left. That's Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8 South at Thorncrest Drive.
I can't remember the last time I went to the dentist. Now I'm too embarrassed to go because my teeth are in such bad condition.
Unfortunately, this person is not alone. Many folks put off going to the dentist because they fear being scolded for neglecting their teeth. This is Dr. Bob Todd with a special message. Dentistry today is faster, easier, and better than ever before. At our dental office, we don't believe in making you feel guilty, no matter how long it has been since you've seen a dentist. We know fear and embarrassment can cause a cycle of procrastination. If it has been years since you've been to the dentist, call us today. We will help put your mind at ease and bring your smile back to health.
If you hate going to the dentist but know you have a dental problem, help is only a phone call away. Dr. Bob Todd and his friendly dental team will answer all your questions and care for all your concerns. For complimentary information or to schedule an appointment at their Butler office on Evan City Road, please call 282-7774 or on the web at butlersmiles.com.
So. Welcome back, folks. I've been glancing through the catalog here for courses coming up through the Institute for Learning in Retirement. The very first one in the contents, Verna Call, is Antarctica and Argentina, the end of the world.
Yep.
And yes. You're giving that course?
Yes, I am.
Because you've been to Antarctica?
Yes, back in February.
February of this year?
Yes.
Holy moly. Wow.
Hot off the press.
So was Tom. He was with
so
me.
So you went together?
Yes.
Well,
it was a cruise.
It was 2 weeks, and we didn't get to land personally on the actual land at Galphin Island, but we cruised around it close enough for photography and to sight penguins and other animals and things.
So just for example, if someone signed up for this course, you would be showing pictures?
Yeah, I got a PowerPoint of photography that I will be showing at two different classes because that's much involved. So I'm going to do two classes of it. And but the wonderful thing about it is you get to see these things like in the Falkland Islands, in Ushuaia at the very southern tip, which is, they claim, the end of the world living area. And, of course, traveling around where the, you know, icebergs are and glaciers and all those things. But also, they'll get to see some of the things of Argentina, which is quite an interesting place. The Patagonia area, the Pampas, places like that in Argentina as well.
Tierra del Fuego.
Yes, that's right. Down at the very southern area. We've been there to the national park.
And we learned how
where
it
the
got
fire
its name.
Is. Yeah. Because the people there were used bonfires and things along the coastal area.
The natives.
I've never taken Spanish, but Tierra del Fuego is land of fire. Is that
land
what
of fire? Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So you went there in February. Now that would be summertime in Antarctica.
Very
right?
much so. And we were there. Actually, Tom figured it out. He pointed out to me that we were there at the, how would you say, not only the opposite time of the year, but also the longest daylight time of the year.
That's right.
Well.
Yes. That would be reversed as well.
Right. Yeah. And so does the moon. I have photo of the moon looking like the craters are upside down.
Wow.
Because we live in the northern hemisphere.
You are on the other side of the earth.
That's how we're used to seeing it.
That's right.
Yeah. So. Are you teaching any other courses in the fall semester, Verna?
Yes, I'm teaching the one called Evolution, Climate Change, and God's Creation.
Wow.
And that's a meeting of the minds between my science background and my religious ministry that I've done.
Well, that's a fascinating. Well, they're all fascinating, aren't they?
Yeah.
All of these.
Well, it's just like thinking from the both sides of my brain at once, so to speak, with that one.
Tom, what about you? Are you facilitating any of these classes?
No, I'm not. But what I am going to do is I'm going to maybe hit my limit of how many I can take.
Ah.
It just seems that I have maybe a strange brain because I'm interested in a lot of different things. And we typically do have an amazing amount of topics. We work hard to provide areas of interest for everybody. We typically have something on current events, history, health, Verna's mentioned travel,
mm-hmm.
hobbies, the law, and self-improvement. There's usually several things on that.
Some of them are very practical, I see. Mm-hmm. For example, here's a course called A Healthcare Planning in Retirement.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Here's one about senior living options. And some other stuff, too, that would be very practical. No pension, no problem.
And even the subject you're going to be talking about later, military intelligence, is there as well.
That military intelligence course is being taught by a retired Air Force intelligence officer.
Opera.
Oh.
Shakespeare at 400. 400 years.
Yep.
What is news? Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. French 101. Pick up a little bit of French, huh?
Yeah, that class has actually been canceled.
That's the only one.
It's the only one. The teacher had a late conflict.
So
but
that happens. Maybe next semester.
We'll go for it next semester, perhaps.
You speak several languages, Verna?
I speak a little Spanish, and I can read Greek and Hebrew somewhat.
Wow.
Not
be difficult to get into any serious language study in short-term courses like this.
So. Yeah, if we do anything like that, it would be more an intro class for someone who would like at least to have the pleasantries of conversation, such as good morning and thank you and excuse me and things like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And help you if you're traveling to those areas.
Perhaps.
Yeah. One other thing is we do have things on tourism locally in the area, classes. We also have luncheon out, which is kind of neat. And they have one of them has discussions going during the lunch, and the other one is just trying to do different restaurants in the area. So,
how did this all start? It started in, you're still in Slippery Rock. That's where the classes
are. We
are
in Slippery Rock. And it started with a Slippery Rock University connection. Dr. Connie Smith, wife of Slippery Rock Professor Warren Smith, in 2001, thought there could be a very good need here. There seemed to be a lot of people who want to know things and are curious. And at the same time, some of our professors who are retiring don't know anything except instructing. Well, they know the results of their research, of course. So maybe we could pair them up a little bit. So we started offering classes that way, and the response was phenomenal. We thought we needed about 60 members to make it work. The first year we got 97. Now, I'll also say the first year we only had 12 classes as opposed to the 60 to 70 we have each term now. So that'd be 60 to 70 in the fall and 60 to 70 in the spring. And that was also before we thought of some of the trips that we would take. We do, in fact, offer these day trips. And it sort of rounds out the experience. Sometimes the classes may combine with the trips a little bit. Not that you're obligated, but when we had a lady named Pauli Shaw teach us about Frank Preston, his life story, the one who began Moraine Park and Preston Park and founded American Glass Research, she gave a classroom presentation on it. And then later in the semester, she organized a tour of Preston Park and those buildings there that constitute the grounds on his estate.
Some of the trips that are coming up, Pittsburgh Conservatory for the Fall Flower Show, Pennsylvania Trolley Museum, Pittsburgh Zoo, Moraine Cruise at Lake Arthur, and more. Folks, I don't even have time to read all of these fascinating courses that you could take if you like movies. I'm a great movie lover. There's a course called now I lost all. Here it is. Frightening Films of the Silent Era. There's another one on Fanny and Alexander, Swedish film. Mm-hmm. It's good stuff. Disney, Walt Disney and his movies. So many different categories. Go online. The whole catalog is online at
www.ilretirement.org.
Well, you can call 724-738-1604 and request a catalog, and they'll send you one. And there's an order form in here, too, in addition to a brief summary of all the various classes and who the facilitator is and so on and so forth. There's an order form in here. You can either join the Institute for Learning in Retirement, or you could want to try it out, just take one or two courses. You can do that as well.
Some of the classes are not open to members. It's only fair to say that, only because we have to, you know, kind of give our members priority. Yeah. And there's only so many seats in the classroom. And by the way, the biggest trip we have this time around is the one to the Flight 93 National Memorial. And that, I'm signing up for that because I keep saying I'm going to go. I keep saying I have to do that. Yeah. And, you know, I've never gotten around to it. So it's like, okay, I'm going to do it with a group. I'll be with some of my friends. And I don't even have to make the arrangements. And that's an all-day trip in this case because it's further than we usually go.
I've been there. It's a somber trip. And it is out in the middle of nowhere. So it's hard to get there if you don't know exactly where you're going. Yeah. Well, this is just a wonderful program. I'm so happy that it's still going strong and getting bigger all the time, for that matter. The Institute for Learning in Retirement at Slippery Rock University. Are the classes held actually at the university, or is it another location in Slippery Rock?
Actually, we were connected with the university where we have a loose relationship with them now. We have our own building. It's called the Fowler Building. It's right at the public parking lot for free near the fire station. Its address is on Elm Street.
Oh, I know where that is.
And
downtown Slippery
Rock. It's used by students at the university as well.
But, there is another group that uses the building.
Yeah, there are others that use it, but we're
it's a business
most.
Application class of some kind because they have special computers. Mm-hmm. We have sometimes taken a class there and then walked across the street to North Country Brewery to have lunch.
Sounds like a plan.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Verna, nice to meet you.
Well, nice meeting you as well, Dave.
Yeah. And Tom, good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with a retired CIA man. Philip, does sound a little intimidating, doesn't it? Philip Mudd, who's not in Butler, but we'll be chatting with him by telephone in the Washington, D.C. area. Stick around a couple of minutes here. Back with more of the Friday edition of It's Your Turn right after this.
I was just 49 when I started getting mail from AARP. AARP? Shoot, I was just getting started in life. Then I hit my 60s and retirement was on my mind. The big question was, did I prepare? What about healthcare? Are my finances in order? Not just for my wife and me, but for the kids and grandkids. I got the answers I needed from attorney Michael Pater, specializing in elder law, long-term care, Medicaid, and wills and estate planning, is attorney Michael Pater in the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center. Phone 287-7724.
Tobacco for Less is Western PA's largest glass emporium, and they now have a store in Butler at Pullman Square Plaza. What makes Tobacco for Less different from other stores? For starters, they have so many glass pipes to choose from. They also feature a walk-in humidor and a vape juice bar. And of course, they carry a variety of standard tobacco products too. The Tobacco for Less Health and Wellness Department stocks a large selection of high-quality CBD products. For all your smoking and vaping needs, check out Tobacco for Less with locations in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Listeners, I think you're going to be interested coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey, and we're going to be chatting with Philip Mudd about the fascinating recounting of some work by the CIA. First of all, Philip Mudd, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks for having me on today.
We want to talk about your newly published book entitled Black Sight, the CIA and the post-9/11 world. First of all, Philip, you're a former director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center. You are also working with the FBI's National Security Branch, I believe, correct?
That's right. A rare person who crossed over the Potomac River doing both sides, the domestic side, which is the Bureau, and the foreign side, which was the agency, something that when I came up was not that common back in the day.
Well, first of all, I think we ought to make sure that all of our listeners are on the same page with the black sites. What exactly are black sites?
Pretty basic. This was controversial back when it started there at the CIA, and talked to a lot of my friends about it. Back in 2002, in the heat of the counter-terror war, the CIA, working with some partners, captured the first high-end al-Qaeda prisoner. They had picked up a guy named Abu Zubaydah in spring of 2002, and Abu Zubaydah stopped speaking to his captors, and the CIA had the decision what to do with them, and they made a fateful choice. They looked in the mirror, these are a lot of my friends whom I interviewed, and said, we're not only going to interrogate them ourselves, we're going to set up our own secret prisons overseas, and those secret prisons were known as black sites.
Was this legal?
It was. One of the real challenges in the book was talking to a bunch of lawyers about the conversation between the CIA and the Department of Justice when the CIA said, we want to do this, but we're not going to do it unless we have a legal judgment from the Department of Justice saying this complies with U.S. law. So there was a lot of back and forth for years, even after the black sites were established, with the Department of Justice, to get paper after paper after paper where the Justice Department told the CIA in writing that what they did was not only constitutional but also complied with federal law in the United States.
Why did we have to base them in foreign countries, Philip Mudd?
A pretty basic reason. There was a conversations among the senior executives at the CIA back then 17 years ago about bringing captives back to the United States. The problem with that is as soon as you put them through in the U.S. judicial process, they get a lawyer, and the lawyer says, don't speak. And the concern back then was, if we don't get information from these detainees, the CIA didn't have a great picture of al-Qaeda back then. If these detainees don't talk, and they have information that could help us understand al-Qaeda and maybe prevent an attack, would we think that's a good option? And I think the CIA guys I spoke with didn't think there were any good options, and the least bad option was maybe holding them overseas so they didn't get access immediately to lawyers.
Well, lots of questions about these black sites. In fact, they've been circulating for years. For example, how were the al-Qaeda prisoners transported to these black sites?
Private planes. What typically would happen would be you'd be conducting a raid in a foreign country. The country where you captured the individual didn't want to keep the al-Qaeda prisoners that we helped capture. So the CIA had a private fleet of planes. They would check the prisoner to make sure he was safe to travel, put a blindfold on him, and put him on a plane and take him to another country so that the prisoner didn't even know where he was. He didn't know what time of day it was. He didn't know how long he would be there. But it was all a formal CIA process to transfer prisoners using private planes to sites around the world.
What did these secret prisons look like? A typical jail cell or something else?
I would say more antiseptic. There's a couple of unique characteristics in prisons like this. When I talked to people who ran some of the prisons, they would talk, for example, about the fact that everybody's held in isolation. There's constant light so that the prisoner doesn't know when it's day and when it's night. There aren't clocks around, so the prisoner doesn't have a good sense of time. Although some prisoners, interestingly, tried occasionally figured out what time of day it was, and we could thought it was kind of interesting how they did it. There's background noise to try to prevent the prisoners from talking to each other or hearing anything in the prison. There's cameras everywhere. There's sort of an antiseptic smell. So you have a real sort of somewhere between a prison and a hospital, I suppose. Cells for each individual prisoner so they couldn't compare notes, but a real antiseptic environment.
Do any of these black sites still exist, to your knowledge, Philip Mudd?
No, they don't exist anymore. Back early, quicker than you might have expected, the first black site was established in 2002. By 2006 or 2007, there are already serious questions about whether this was a long-term solution for al-Qaeda prisoners. The prisons had been shut down, some of them, when President Bush was ending his second term, and then when President Obama came in, he said, not only are we not doing these, but this wasn't the right thing to do, and we'll never do it again. So that these sites haven't existed for more than a decade.
Why didn't we use Guantanamo?
there was some conversation about Guantanamo, but again, as soon as you put somebody into Guantanamo, you have potential for that person to have access to lawyers, to people who might begin speaking about who's there. So your cover is essentially blown. The idea was, we want to keep them in facilities where nobody knows where they are and nobody outside the CIA will have access to them.
We're talking, listeners, with Philip Mudd. He's the author of a new book entitled Black Sight, the CIA in the Post-9/11 World. You're no stranger to covert operations or enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, let's talk about that a little bit, because, you know, we heard back in the day about waterboarding and all that stuff. What are your thoughts on that, sir?
The challenge that the agency had, and it sort of matches my thoughts since I was there for part of this stuff, was if people don't want to speak and they're just going to sit there and tell you, one of the prisoners looked at one of his interrogators and said, you ought to go home and have babies because I'm not going to talk anymore. Is there a way to use techniques like sleep deprivation to make a prisoner say, I don't like the conditions I'm being held in. They're so uncomfortable that maybe I can give up a little information in exchange for better treatment. These were techniques that had been used to train U.S. military on how to resist interrogation. And what the CIA said was, the same stuff we train our guys on resisting, we're going to use against CIA detainees. So that the idea was, make them so uncomfortable that they say the only way out is to start talking.
Have you had any blowback from high-ranking government figures since your book has come out, Philip?
No, not yet. It hasn't been out too long. I confess I'm waiting for that to happen. I have had a couple colleagues say that they appreciate that I told their story, and one of the guys who was really critical, an anonymous guy who's really critical to the interrogation program, wrote me and said it's the best narrative he's ever read of the program. That I actually felt pretty good about that one. But I'm anticipating somebody's eventually going to walk up or write and give me a hard time about it. It hasn't happened yet, but I think it'll happen eventually.
There hasn't been much discussion, or to my knowledge, nothing else written about these until your book. Am I correct on that?
There has been some written. The Senate wrote formal studies of them that were highly critical going back to 2014. Some of my colleagues wrote their individual stories, you know, what they experienced. But the reason I wrote it, to your point, is I was thinking one day, nobody has actually talked to a lot of these guys. I probably interviewed 35 or 40 former colleagues. They spoke because I know most of them, and I think they trusted me not to either mistell their story or identify them. I didn't know of anybody who would ever actually put the whole story together in a narrative that somebody would find readable. So I don't know of any other place where this exists.
Wow, that's surprising, because weren't there Senate hearings or some sort of a Senate report on this about 5 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are a couple of Senate reports on it, and there's a few public CIA reports on it. But in terms of people in private life, people who have left government talking to colleagues to try to tell the story in a sort of book form, not a Senate report form. The Senate report's pretty tough to read. I don't know. My friends told individual stories, as I said, but not a comprehensive story where people went around interviewing a bunch of former colleagues.
This was known, this whole black site operation, this was known as the program. That was like kind of a code word for what was going on. Is that right?
Although I'm not sure I'd call it a code word. It's just, when we were walking around the halls of the CIA, if you said the program, that meant the interrogation program. It was just, I would call it more shorthand as opposed to a code word. It was known among those of us who are aware of it as the program. Pretty simple.
Your book has been reviewed as a very balanced assessment of this program, so you're not exactly talking about this as an expose. You say that many of these moves that were made by the CIA were deeply thought out, and maybe, you know, people thought it was what we had to do back then.
They did, and a lot of the book has to deal with trying to explain to people what it was like to live in the CIA. The program was well thought out over time. I will say, the book early on, you mentioned balances, exposes some of the difficulties and mistakes, and there were some tremendous mistakes early in the program when the CIA was trying to figure, I mean, this isn't what the CIA does. They run spies. They don't run prisons. to say I made a lot of mistakes early on that my friends talked about, but it did mature that as the program over time, as the CIA learned more and more about how to run these prisons, and then very quickly started to shut them down when America sort of lost the momentum that was so that so unified America after 9/11. Within a few years, people started asking more and more questions about the sites, and as I said, they shut down in 06, 07, 08.
How many of these sites were there, and do we know what countries they were in?
Oh, we do. If I told you that, that's one thing that would get me in a heck of a lot of trouble. You're talking about maybe round figures, a handful in different places around the world, but the conversations with foreign governments were, we'll never tell where we had these because we didn't want these governments coming under scrutiny for having cooperated with us.
Were they necessarily allies of the United States or perhaps not?
No, they had to be allies or at least friends because you're walking into a foreign country saying, can you take great risk for us? Can you allow us to maintain a secret facility in your country where we're going to put the most senior Al-Qaeda operatives, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 911, that we're going to put them in private in prisons in your country. So these countries knew, by and large, what was going on and who was there, and there's no way you can walk in a room and ask a country to do that unless not only are they an ally, but they trust you to keep the relationship secret.
I think we have to, in all fairness, Philip Mount, we have to go back to what the nation felt like. And it's almost 20 years ago now. But people were at first shocked by the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I mean, goodness gracious, planes crashed into the World Trade Centers. There were four of them altogether, as I recall. Two planes into the World Trade Centers. Another crashed into the Pentagon, for goodness sakes. And another one right here in Pennsylvania that was apparently headed for either the U.S. Capitol building or the White House, but which came down in Somerset, PA, here in Western Pennsylvania. Well, when all this happened in one day, the nation was just absolutely shocked and then very quickly very angry. So it was with this sort of a response that the CIA and the federal government had to act. I imagine there were a lot of people within the CIA who were very angry, too.
I think angry, but the sentiment, when I did all the interviews, the sentiment that people spoke to me about was obviously sadness about what happened before and on the day of 9/11, but the overarching sentiment was, look, it's on us to make sure this doesn't happen again. And probably a third or maybe more of the book is setting the scene so people who weren't there or were forgotten understand the tension of the times, particularly within the halls of the CIA. People were looking in the mirror and saying, if we make a mistake, if we're not aggressive enough, and there's another catastrophic attack, America's going to look at us and say, how did you let this happen? Among my colleagues, there was a great sense of responsibility, a burden. And then for years, there was a great sense that we were fighting an adversary we didn't fully understand, which is why the detainees were so important. They helped us understand Al-Qaeda.
Philip Mudd, were you the director of the CIA Counterterrorist Center at the time of the 9/11 attacks, or did you assume that position later?
No, I was actually at the Executive Office Building of the White House, right next to the West Wing on the day of the attacks. That the plane you mentioned that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, we thought the plane might be coming for us. I think it was intended for the Congress, in Washington. But I was evacuated from the Executive Office Building, the White House, almost immediately after the second plane hit. Downtown Washington was just chaotic. You mentioned the Pentagon. I remember, I don't even know how long it was, hour and a half later, trying to get across the bridge outside Washington and watching the smoke billow up from the Pentagon. And we just sat, you know, you're just saying, what is happening to America? It was a surreal day, like living in a Hollywood movie, just incredible.
Unbelievable day. And as I recall, the president, who had been somewhere in the South, appearing at a school,
Florida.
I believe, was Georgia, did you say?
Florida, I think he was in.
Florida. But he was spirited away, I think temporarily, aboard Air Force One, not brought back to Washington right away because of the fact that we didn't really know what was going to be happening the rest of the day, correct?
Oh, heck yes. You know, I remember people, all these rumors. There was a rumor that the State Department had been hit. There was a rumor that there were more planes in the air. You mentioned rightly that four planes were hijacked, I mean, for a couple hours, I don't think people knew how many planes were being hijacked. And then you go forward a few weeks, people have forgotten. Separately, there are anthrax letters in the fall of 2001, and people like me thought, oh, maybe this is the second wave of attacks. Maybe this is Al-Qaeda sending anthrax letters. The sense of uncertainty was like, it was just pervasive. Nobody actually knew what the heck was going on, which is one reason the president was flying around the country in different places. People didn't want to bring him back to Washington.
You say you were evacuated. Did you go to one of those secret bunkers, or are you not permitted to say where you went?
No, it was so chaotic. I went home. I could not get back in the executive office building, White House. There was a lot of military around that day trying to protect the facility, the White House compound, obviously. I went home like everybody else. I went to see some friends, and for hours was just watching the video of the buildings falling, and you just sat there and said, this is just, it was just hard to believe. It looked like it was like a movie. You couldn't believe it. And then a couple days later, we were called back to the White House, and that's when pretty much the counter Al-Qaeda program began.
You're not with the CIA any longer, Philip Mudd?
No, I quit some years ago. I did 25 years and looked in the mirror and said, I think that's about time to go on and do something else. Worry less about terrorists and more about improving my cooking skills. I left a few years ago.
It's understandable. I can remember how upset I was at that time. I can imagine if you had been with the CIA. Gosh, when did you decide to write this book?
A couple years ago, it occurred to me that I like to write, so that's a piece of it. But it occurred to me that if nobody spoke to my friends and colleagues, most of them would never speak. Most of them would never write a book, and nobody would probably talk to 35 or 40 of them and put it all together. So it was just one morning I was running, and a light bulb went on, and I said, I'm going to talk to all my former colleagues. I'm going to ask what their stories were. They'll talk to me because I was there with them, and I'm going to write the book. That was about it. It was a pretty simple concept. I just wanted to write the story of what happened with my peers at the CIA.
You said your book is only recently published. It's available, however, to the general public now?
Yep, you can go to a bookstore. Of course, you can get it on Amazon. If you want an audio book, you can buy Kindle. I still have paper. I still read paper, so you can get a paper copy. But most major bookstores will have it, or just pop on Amazon. You can find it, Black Site under Philip Mudd.
Black Site, the CIA in the post-9/11 world. Do you think we'll ever have black sites again, Philip Mudd?
I do not. I think my colleagues who went through that program know that if they were asked to do it again, at some point the Congress is going to step in and say, we don't like this. So my friends thought what happened was effective, that the CIA did its job, but it's hard for me to imagine going back to that era again. I don't think so.
Again, listeners, this is not an attack. This is a very sober and balanced assessment of the program, the post-9/11 strategy developed by the CIA. With Philip Mudd, our guest here for the last few minutes. Nice to meet you, sir. Terrific to talk with you today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Sure. So long. Back to school time. The kids need new shoes. New athletic shoes, new tennis shoes for back to school. Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street, downtown Butler, the place to go. You know, Miller's been around for 126 years, and they have all of the famous name brand athletic shoes right there under one roof. Whether it's Nike or New Balance or Saucony or Rockport or Keds or Children's Skechers or Easy Spirit or Asics or Pro-Pit, they've got them all right there, Miller's Shoes. And also, SAS Comfort Shoes, including SAS Comfort Sandals in a variety of styles and colors. Stop in, say hello to the Ciprians at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Still more to come on It's Your Turn. We'll be chatting with author Judy Kelly in just a moment.
When planning a funeral, many times there's the question of cremation. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler can answer your questions about cremation. Is cremation appropriate? Should there be a funeral service? How would your family feel about cremation? And of course, what's the cost? Keep in mind that even with cremation, it's a time to celebrate the meaningful life of your loved one. It's a precious time. Cremation has three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's local. Thompson Miller Cremation Program is right here in Butler at our newly created facility. We assure you that your loved one will never leave our care at any point in the process. So let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller. Call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller, at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Coming up, listeners, we're going to be talking about a new novel by author Judy Kelly, who joins us for a few minutes here on It's Your Turn Today. I'm Dave Malarkey. Hi, Judy. How you doing? Nice to talk to you.
Well, Dave, it's nice to talk to you, too.
We want to talk about your novel, Blessings and Curses.
Yes.
Your protagonist, your main character, is Olivia Douglas. Talk a little bit about her. Who's Olivia?
Olivia is the main character, and she has been assigned by her parish priest to go and talk to an inmate on death row. She has this feeling that there's a curse over her, and she thought maybe she wasn't religious enough, didn't know enough about God, and her faith was not deep enough. So she completed 3 years in the seminary, and then when she came out, she realized this feeling, this thing that she described as a curse, is still hanging over her. And she went to her parish priest to let him know that she could not be a priest. You know, who would want a priest with a curse hanging over them anyway? So he gave her this assignment to talk to this inmate on death row. And then it was there that he asked her at the end of his life for a personal request. And then she stumbles on something in her past that threatens to uproot her, the ordinary life that she has with her adopted family.
This man, prisoner that's on death row, his name in your novel is Leon Sunstrick Wilkerson. And Olivia finds out that, he's really been a bad guy, convicted of the murder of actually a number of young women, right?
Yes. Hmm. But when she enters, she doesn't have a desire to find out anything about him. Not that she didn't need to or that she didn't have to. She just felt like she just really didn't have to. She was not sent there to make judgment on him at all or tell him what he didn't do right or anything like that. She was just there ministering to him, wanting him to feel that somebody cares about him and that somebody loves him. He was actually cruel and mean to her when they first met. He was demeaning, and so she ran out of there. But she decided to come back. And the next day she addressed him as Sir, Mister, and he had never had anyone to show him any respect before, and he mentions that to her. And so she softens him. And I want readers to see how just being kind to people, how people can change because of that kindness that you show them. And some of his anger was gone, and she was now able to talk to him. She saw in him the kind of man he was beyond that hardened shell that he put over himself to protect himself against people, against things that were against him in life. And she saw a man who was on death row, who was dying. He was very vulnerable and, you know, questioning himself perhaps, which way am I going? Am I going up or am I going down in life? We all don't want to die alone, and we all have a question about where we're going, what happens to us. And she saw this in him, and she thought it was her job to be with him on his journey to his next step.
Your convict character, Wilkerson, has only a few days before his scheduled execution. Do you set this novel in any particular location, Judy Kelly, because there are some states, Pennsylvania among them, we haven't had an execution here in Pennsylvania for decades, and there are some states where that's actually, there's a moratorium in place. Do you set your novel in any specific state?
Well, Virginia does have a death row, and so yes, the I actually saw a picture online of the the prison, and so I kind of described a prison the way we she enters and that from the picture that I saw online. Unfortunately, you can't take a tour of the prison. I did kind of drive out there and got as close as I could to see how it was set up and everything so that I could describe it, but you can't, I guess for security reasons, you can't get that close to the prison. But Virginia does have a death row.
Judy Kelly, listeners, is an adjunct professor at Montgomery College in Maryland. What do you teach there, Judy?
English. I've taught speech and college reading.
Mm-hmm. And you once taught in high school as well there, right?
I certainly did. In fact, the novel, Olivia Douglas, is based on my students. I taught English in high school, and my students were had all kinds of backgrounds. I had many students who came from other countries, and just many, many things happening to them. And all of them said the same things to me. I don't have any value. I don't know when the ones who came from other countries. I don't know why my parents brought us here. They were kind of in the middle. So the parents spoke one language in the home, and they had one culture there. And the students now are trying to mesh themselves into this new culture that they are supposed to assimilate in. And they were having difficulties being accepted and learning the culture and the language. So they kind of found themselves in the middle. And so they had lost their desire. They had lost the faith in themselves and the system and their parents and everything. And they just, told me things like they don't have any value, nobody cares about them, what could they do in life anyway. I just believe that everybody is given a gift. Everybody is given a gift. Even the most disabled person has a gift that they're giving to someone else. So that might be a gift for me to learn how to minister to the disabled person, but that's that person's gift. And so I, now having that feeling, I just decided I'm gonna help them find their gifts and use that, because everybody's here now and we can't worry about what happened in the past and what used to be, but let's take the here and now, and I'm gonna push all my students forward as much as I possibly can. And so I, in writing the story, I started thinking about all of the things that they said and the background, students who came from all kinds of things, and you have to help them find their worth and value people. And again, this is what Olivia Douglas does to this man she ministers to in the prison.
I read one of the reviews of your book, Judy, the title, Listeners, Blessings and Curses. It listed the genre as Christian romance. Do you have a little romance that you weave into this story about Olivia?
Yes, I do. And I was, I met with a group not too long ago, and I said, I was trying to make the man sexy, and all the women said, you did. So the man is sexy for the female listeners out there. We have to have somebody sometimes to help us along on our own journey. And she meets someone who is also struggling, and so, but they care for each other and they minister to each other. She says she's unaware of his struggles at first, but he knows her and he knows himself, and he hears the things that she's saying and the suggestions that she's making about the inmate, and he's accepting them for himself as well, and getting healed in the process.
Blessings and Curses is the title of the book. Judy, have you written any other books?
Yes, I have the one that's on the Amazon now, and also on my website, That Ever Died So Young, and I'm working on another one currently.
Judy Kelly, our guest. Judy, nice to talk with you. Thanks for being with us for a few minutes here today.
Well, thank you. Can I give you my website address?
Oh, please do. Yes, please give it to us.
Okay. My blog is www.judycar.com, and the blog is entitled Love a Good Story. And the book can be also purchased on Amazon, www.amazon.com. Blessings and curses, Judy Kelly.
Thanks, Judy. Have a good day.
Thank you so very much. I'm so happy that I had a chance to talk with you.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.